awesome to be here this morning. There would be no other church that I would be at this week or even in these 3 months, because Pacific just threw me on to sabbatical, where I'm supposed to just take it easy. And it's my second sabbatical at Pacific. The first one I killed myself doing some doctoral research, and this one I said, if I'm taking this one, I am just purely playing with my boys. And they go, absolutely, add a few more weeks. And so, but when Dave and Sid said, Jim, could you preach for us, because we're both gone on the same day? You guys need an executive pastor. How does that happen? But anyways, I said, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I spent my first years of ministry at Hope Community Church. And and it was in the very days that they were meeting at the Christian school there on 160th, right? And I think it was Ken Bile, I think it was him who said, there's a piece of property over out there in the farmlands, just north of Cloverdale. We should buy it. And some of you remember those days. And the money raised, I think the property then was like $1 million or something, and there was greenhouses here, and landed that property. How many years ago was that now? 17? 15? 20? I'm that old? Oh my goodness. Okay, stop counting. I remember Monica and I saying, oh my goodness, let's give into that. And so I'm here to pick up my loan, really. So, anyways, it's so exciting to see what God has done amongst you. Those of you who sort of held constant, worshiping together, to this day where you took some bold steps required to see this place open up and be a very welcoming, community to everybody around. I'm so proud that I could say I at least interned there. And I'm so excited to see what is up for you guys here in Cloverdale. And as I'm still ministering in Cloverdale at Pacific, I really sense working with Dave and Sid and Candy and the rest, some genuine partnership in terms of what does it look like to be a community that works together for the sake of the whole. And so, very excited. Dave said he started and launched a sermon series on hospitality last week called The Table, Thus the Table. And when he mentioned that, I thought, oh, I could speak right into that. I love the theme of hospitality. And I think it's right at the very heart of God. And when we open ourselves up to the ways of God in terms of hospitality, it's revolutionary. It was so revolutionary, it sort of took people aback when Jesus landed on the ground and ended up eating with people that people normally don't eat with. Remember these words here, Luke chapter 5. Then Levi held a great banquet for Jesus at his house. Welcomes Jesus into his home, his life, and a large crowd of tax collectors and others were eating with them. Somehow Levi had this sense that Jesus wanted to hang out with people who people usually don't hang out with. And Levi puts out this great spread, but the Pharisees and teachers of the law who perhaps were invited but didn't show up, who belonged to their sect, complained to his disciples, why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners? Why do you do that? And Jesus answered them, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. You guys already have it all together, don't you? You don't need me. I'll come to those who are hungry, as we sang, who need, who are longing. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. People who are mucked up to a new way of life. People looking for a way to live in this world. Jesus, of course, is the primary demonstrator of hospitality. We don't really have to go too much further to look for somebody in the Bible who is hospitable that should encourage us to be people of the table. People who think about ministry around food. Because, I mean, hospitality and food, it goes without saying. I mean, throughout the Bible, in fact, we see very clear indication that hospitality is at the very heart of what it means to be God's people. In Hebrews chapter 13, a message at Pacific a couple of weeks ago emphasized, do not show neglect to show hospitality to strangers. Don't neglect that. Because if you neglect it, you're totally missing the boat. Hospitality is something that is at the very heart of what it means to be God's people. Or 1 Peter chapter 4, show hospitality with one another. In other words, be nice to each other, invite each other around without grumbling. Peter has this notion, I think, that embedded here that hospitality ain't easy. That you need to show hospitality, make that step, do the move, despite the fact that it can be very challenging. Even showing hospitality to some of your kids can be hard. And to do that without grumbling. But it's not just a New Testament concept, it's an Old Testament concept. It's part of what we even see throughout the beginning of Scripture to the very end. You shall, in Leviticus chapter 19, you shall treat this stranger, God is saying to Israel, who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. I don't know. Jesus sort of summarized the commands using that language, didn't he? You shall love one another as yourself. So hospitality is a big deal in the Bible, a very big deal. And it's always around food. I mean, in fact, when you think about it, think about the temple. Think about the construction of the temple. What was at the very center of the temple, apart from the Holy of Holies? Bread. Right? When they built the temple, they had this, what? Right in the courtroom there. What did they have right in the middle? They had a bloody barbecue that was bigger than anything else. I mean, they didn't know how to barbecue. They used boiled water to do chicken, but meats. But nevertheless, what did you do when you brought your offerings? What did you do? You ate with who? Each other and with God. Food was the very thing that described the relationship of God's people. Food, food, food. In fact, at the very end of Scripture, one of the most beautiful images I love is when it describes the new heavens and the new earth. And in the New Jerusalem, there's a tree that grows right by the river of life. And it's an amazing tree. We don't see a tree like this anywhere in any orchard on earth right now. But it's a tree that has 12 different kinds of fruit that season at different times of the month each year. So there's always food on the tree. What a beautiful image. Where the people of God gather, where all is nourished. So how crazy is hospitality? How big of a deal is this? Because we see that it sort of grows a long time in the people of Israel. But there's a story in the Old Testament that I sort of gravitated to when Dave asked me, hey, can you preach? And I'm on my sabbatical. I got to find the, my favorite sermon that I can just preach just like that. And right away popped into my mind was Joshua 9. But in Joshua 9, chapter 9, which is right when Israel is coming out of the 40 years of wandering, and they're coming into the new land, and they experience the Jericho walls falling, and then their failure at Ai, and then God forgives them, and they renew their covenant. And now God says, now go take over Canaan and exterminate everybody that's in your way, because, you know, they've lived out the fullness of their evil, and it's time for them to be cleansed, and because the creation is vomiting them out, and I'm using you to not only give the promised land, but for you to clean things up. You're my hammer. And so Joshua 9 is where Israel, these strangers in this new land, are making their way in the most inhospitable fashion. Are you a Canaanite? Great, over there. Knife is yours. I mean, we're taking your home, we're taking your farm, and that cattle looks really good on my property, which was yours, but now mine. I mean, if you look at the book of Joshua, it's the most inhospitable text. In fact, if you read the Bible for the first time and you start at Genesis and you get to Joshua, you're like, oh my goodness, I thought God was a God of love. What's happening here? Is this how we're supposed to live today? How am I supposed to? Let's skip Joshua. And many do. Because it's bloody, it's violent, it's genocidal. It's everything that Jesus seemed to be preaching against. And so I want to take this theme of hospitality and contrast it with, well, not contrast, but take a look at chapter 9, because here we do see the heart of hospitality in an amazing way. I'm going to read through this story because it's a time when Joshua and the camp of Israel is ready to go, but they get some visitors. And it's and in the NIV is titled The Gibeonite Deception. So it's going to be up here. I'll read through it and comment as I go. And then 4 points that we can take from this passage here this morning. So chapter 9, read with me if you can. Now when all the kings west of the Jordan, after heard about Jericho, heard about these things, Jericho and Ai and all those things, the kings in the hill country of Israel, in the western foothills, and along the entire coast of the Mediterranean Sea as far as Lebanon, the kings of the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, they came together to wage war against Joshua and Israel. So here's Canaan. They know perhaps what's coming. They know that there's this band of landless people who want their land. Well, what do? Well, you fight for your land. You're not taking my house. So it's no surprise when they hear the news of Joshua and Israel coming to take their land, they are sharpening their stones, they're organizing themselves, they're coming out of the foothills, and they're going to confront Israel and stop them in their tracks and send them back over the Jordan. However, in verse 3, when the people of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, I mean, wouldn't you be spooked? If you heard about this nation of Israel that comes in and they walk around 7 times around the city and the city falls without an arrow being strung, would you be shaking in your boots? Though many took to the sword, Gibeon, after hearing this, resorted to a ruse, a trick. They went as a delegation whose donkeys were loaded with worn-out sacks and old wineskins, cracked and mended. They put worn and patched sandals on their feet and wore old clothes. All the bread of their food supply was dry and moldy. Then they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal and said to him and the Israelites, "We have come from a distant country. Make a treaty with us." Unlike their cousins, unlike the other cities in Canaan, which they were in league with, they chose something different than waging war. They came to them, instead of a war, to seek a treaty of peace. And they knew that it wouldn't be good just with a letter. They would have to do it by trickery. So they pretend to not be Canaanites. And they pretend that they've come from a very far land and want to now partner with Israel. Pretty good. Verse 7, "And the Israelites said to the Hivites," now somebody's writing this after this episode, because the Hivites do name them as, that's a name of the Canaanites. "The Israelites said to the Hivites," they're not totally taken, "perhaps you live near us, so how can we make a treaty with you?" So Israel is aware that it's possible that they're being duped. It's quite possible. Of course, you wouldn't want to wage war if you could do something a little bit easier, like pretending you're not a Canaanite. Because if you're not a Canaanite, you can live. And they move on further, and so they respond. No. He says, "We are your servants. We want to serve you," they said. But Joshua asks, he's still a little bit uncertain, "Who are you? And where do you come from?" And again they answered, "Your servants have come from a very distant country because of the fame of the Lord your God." So it's interesting. Gibeon is very aware of Israel and their God. "For we have heard reports of him, all that he did in Egypt." In fact, they know everything all the way back to the book of Exodus. They know what's been happening. They are aware. It's almost like a preacher has come to them and described to them in great detail about this God in Israel and all that God has done for this people. And so they are digesting this. They are putting this all together. And they're recognizing that if they wage war against their God, it's likely they're not going to win. "And we've heard what you've done in Egypt and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, who reigned in Ashtaroth. We've heard what you've done even just across the Jordan. And our elders and all those living in our country said to us, 'Take provisions for your journey. Go and meet them and say to them, we are your servants.'" They keep on using that word, servants, four times. "We're here to serve you. We're here to be a partner that helps you do what you need to do. Look at this bread," they say. "We want you to make a treaty, but this bread of ours was warm when we packed it at home on the day we left to come to you. But now, see how dry and moldy it is? And these wineskins that we filled were new, but see how cracked they are?" I mean, they went to the minutiae, the detail, to make sure that their story was evidenced by some good, tangible realities here. "Look at our clothes, and our sandals are worn out by the very long journey." And so Israel's sitting there, and they see this stuff. And verse 14, the Israelites sampled their provisions. Okay, let's test this out. Is this what they say it is? But this verse 14 is quite interesting. "The Israelites sampled their provisions, but did not inquire of the Lord." Huh. I would say this is like a turning verse in this chapter. So they get all this evidence, they get this story, they get the scoop from these pretenders, and they do their own investigation, they do their own prodding, But one thing they don't do, which they're told to do, anytime they're in the context of waging war or making treaties of peace, they're supposed to go to the priest who with the, you know, they've got this breastplate of 12 stones, their Urim and Thurim, and, you know, just like a smartphone would be crazy to them, this thing is crazy to us. Like, so somehow the priest goes into some place and inquires of God, and somehow, I don't know, these things might shine or something, but anyways, it in fact mediates God's voice to the people of Israel. Here's what you're supposed to do. And that's what it meant to inquire of the Lord, is to go into this place, seek the word of God through this breastplate. But here, they did not. They didn't. And it makes you wonder, given all that happens, what would God have told them if they did ask? Because God had already told them extermination is the only option. That is the only option. But we don't know. So without asking God, Joshua, given all the evidence, makes a treaty of peace with them to let them live. And the leaders of the assembly ratified it by oath. So everybody buys in. Joshua says, I think this is a good thing. Leaders, what do you think, all of the tribes? We think this is good. Stamp. We're going to do a treaty of peace. So they make this covenant with these pretenders. Now in verse 16. 3 days after they made the treaty with the Gibeonites, the Israelites heard that they were, what? Neighbors living nearby. So the Israelites set out and on the third day came to their cities, Gibeon, Kephirah, Beeroth, and Kiriath Jearim, to do what? To do what God wanted them to do, exterminate them. But the Israelites did not attack them, because the leaders of the assembly, who were beginning to be a little bit concerned, recognized they had sworn an oath to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. So even though they were going to do what God called them to do by the basis of this treaty of peace that they made in the name of the Lord, they realized they couldn't go forward. The power of a treaty. Now, of course, this didn't impress the whole assembly in verse 18. The whole assembly grumbled against the leaders. But all the leaders answered, we have given them our oath by the Lord, the God of Israel, and we cannot touch them now. So the leaders are playing a little bit of defense here. Everybody's wondering what God's going to do. This is what we will do to them instead. We will let them live so that God's wrath will not fall on us for breaking the oath we swore to them. So they recognize God will punish Israel if they break the covenant. But at the same time, they've got to do what's right. So they should punish them in some way. So verse 21, they continued, let them live, but let them be woodcutters and water carriers in the service of the whole assembly. So, okay, given you're in, but you're going to be our water carriers, the most favored tasks in camp, and your woodcutters. You're going to carry our water and cut our wood. And everybody was okay with that. Then Joshua summoned the Gibeonites and said, why did you deceive us by saying we live a long way from you, while actually you live near to us? You are now under a curse. You will never be released from service as woodcutters and water carriers for the house of my God. I think this is hilarious. Okay, as far as curses go, a good curse would be punishment, go into your room, don't get any dinner. But what's the curse? You guys are going to serve the temple. You're going to serve God, serve us, by making sure there's enough firewood and enough water in the temple of God, the very place where God dwells. So Gibeon, who was once outside with a death sentence, is now in the very place where God is. Who came up with that curse? Better is one day in the house of the Lord than 1,000 where? Elsewhere. Death, life. And they answered Joshua, the Gibeonites, "Your servants were clearly told how the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you the whole land and to wipe out all of its inhabitants from before you. So we feared for our lives because of you, and this is why we did this. We are now in your hands. Do to us whatever seems good and right to you." So Joshua saved them. And they did not kill them. And that day he made the Gibeonites woodcutters and water carriers for the assembly to provide for the needs of the altar of the Lord at the place the Lord would choose, the temple. And that is what they are to this day. I think this is an amazing story that highlights in such a significant way hospitality. Now, it's probably not one of your chosen go-to texts on hospitality. Probably not. It's like the opposite. But let me argue a little bit different. Here's this. Four points. In a most inhospitable time, a most hospitable action is taken. We live in a world today where we're quite confused about how far hospitality should go. We live Western Europe, North America, we ask big questions about who should be allowed in. And we wonder how high our walls should be. And in an age where we're uncertain how to deal with the global reality of nations moving all over the place and who belongs and who should be Canadian and who should have the rights of Canadians, you could describe potentially our time as one that's quite inhospitable. Particularly if you're somebody who escaped from your country and you're wondering for a place to live. We have two immigrant families in our community who came out of Turkey. I heard through the prayer that you guys are also following a family. But when you hear their stories, you hear about the inhospitality of the world. And them finding very difficulty in finding a place to live. And so in this story, we see that Israel was not being very hospitable, but at this very moment, they became hospitable. Something happened that changed their whole notion of what it means to be God's people. And it's stunning, you know, that in this chapter 9 that we read, you know, when they found out that Gibeon was in fact their neighbors and therefore needed to be exterminated or be punished for their deception, it took them 3 days to march there to deal them the significant blow, and they stopped. But if you read the next chapter, it turns out that because of the treaty they make with Israel, all the other Canaanite cities get upset with Gibeon. And they all coalesce and they attack Gibeon and its cities. And what does Israel do? Defends them. They rouse up their army. And instead of taking 3 days of anger to get to Gibeon, it's now 1 day. In 1 day, which just a few weeks earlier took 3 days in anger to march, takes 1 day, and they stand in front of Gibeon and challenge the kings. And it's the very day, remember, even God stops the earth so that the day lasts longer. Which is quite fascinating. Because all through chapter 9, they did not inquire of God. We don't even hear God's opinion on this matter. And yet, in chapter 10, God shows up to defend Gibeon. In a most inhospitable time, a most hospitable action is taken. They make a treaty because they've been duped, but given the treaty, they continue to show friendship. And in fact, act with their lives to defend their new friend who just duped them. What an act. In fact, there's a later story in Chronicles where there's famine in the land. And Israel is under, fields aren't growing. People are getting hungry. And David becomes aware that Saul has in fact been seeking to exterminate the Gibeonites in his time. Get them out of here. And God puts a curse on the land. And David comes and deals with the situation. And the curse was lifted. And that's a few generations later. Gibeon becomes part of the community of faith. So in a most inhospitable time, a most hospitable action is taken. And isn't that particular to the Christian community? If there's anybody that should be the most radical in its hospitality, it's who? The church. You look at the coming of Jesus Christ. When he came, was it hospitable? Even those he knew rejected him. But God, in his heart, seeks to eat with those whom he has created, creation and all, and he opens up space for the world to be with him. A very hospitable act towards us. Here's a second point. Our hospitality, if we were to choose to do so, in the name of the Lord, obliges God's hospitality. Here's a situation where Israel didn't inquire of the Lord, creates a treaty of peace, and because they do it in the name of the Lord, God is obliged, even though they're duped. And God, in fact, honors the covenant. And God, in fact, becomes an actor within the development of this relationship. So Israel makes a commitment to a group of people. And it's almost like Israel, despite the fact that they went all about this wrong, in fact, have a way of including a whole other nation into the mix of God's people. And God comes along for the ride, so to speak. Huh. It suggests to me that maybe this is an example of the keys of the kingdom. Whatever you loose here on earth, you loose in heaven. Whatever you bind here on earth, you bind in heaven. There's a sense that you are, in fact, in partnership with God by the actions you take in terms of hospitality and the relationships you make. And so there's a sense of authority or engagement or challenge for us. Who should we be hospitable to, and who would we want to be a part of us and God's people? Why is it that so much of the work in prisons is done by Christian communities? Going to the strangers that are being rejected by society. It's what in Hebrews too, you know, don't neglect to show hospitality to strangers and prisoners. The very, very least of the least of the least, the ones we want out of society, go and take care of. Hospitality is not simply being nice like Martha Stewart. And there's this really sense as a church community, as we go about deciding who's a part of us, it is to be dangerous. And when you go and make a step, it can be profound. I remember the day at Pacific, and we're a church, like as Darcy said, we're way back somewhere. You can't find us unless you're lost. And one day, Bill Reed, who's now since passed and was a great community leader here in Cloverdale, and Shirley Steele, who was the staff sergeant of the RCMP in Cloverdale detachment, knocked on my office door and said, Jim, we know that you're helping with a kitchen over there that Cloverdale Christian Fellowship has started and used, but they're out of the woods now and mix, and now people are doing things on the street. Would your church be open to maybe doing something? I'm like, well, I don't know. We don't have a kitchen. We have a carpeted classroom with a stove and a fridge. We need something. So I go to the board at Pacific, and we had a visioning weekend just on that week that they asked. And I says, what do you guys think? And they go, well, how can we say no? And so we started, and we had a few volunteers that showed up with meals that they ate themselves for the first few times. And Monica would make her lasagna, take the boys with her. A couple other volunteers would come, and the doors were open, but nobody showed. And they just kept on doing that. And now there's 70 people showing up for three different meals per week. And us saying yes to Bill Reed was us encountering something we didn't realize. Senior citizens who can pay the rent but not fill the fridge, or they can fill the fridge but can't pay the rent. We have prisoners who just got out of prison and who are trying to make their way. We have people who have deformed body parts that are unable to work, mental illness, and all of a sudden we're in this mix of things that we don't understand. But now they're throwing money into our bin so that we can build a bigger kitchen. They're the first ones to have done so. And so they're part of this community of faith. And when we make a step, it obliges not only ourselves, but God, and God will show favor. God just brings blessing as we take such steps. A third point. Probably taking way too long, eh? But I don't have a watch on. hospitality makes possible for enemies and strangers to become friends. How do you know who your friends are? It's who you eat with. The only people you eat with, are those who you want to be with. And so often in churches, when you think of, I want to join a group, but I hope they're like me. I hope they like the same things I do. But perhaps we need to do something a little bit more daring in our lives. Say, I wonder if I could be a part of a group where everybody's a stranger, but are different than me. I wonder if God might help us to form a community together. Maybe I should set aside my fears of whether people will like me or whether I will really connect to just letting the Spirit make the connection so that we can have a reconciled community together. Isn't that what the church is all about? Reconciling humanity together under the banner of Jesus Christ the King? And isn't it His capacity that when we step in and say, we're doing this in the name of the Lord, that in fact good things really might happen? You really think Hope Community would have started if a few people didn't say, I don't know who we're going to meet, but let's make new friends in the name of the Lord. I mean, what would it have been like if they built this building and said, friends only on the front door? I mean, the church is all about creating risky relationships that might become reconciled in the name of the Lord, so that in fact our relationships expand. And God's good to you, so you know God was going to show up. So it would suggest to me that if there's no reason to pull back in terms of hospitality. You have every reason to go forward and take some huge risks. Who's at your table? Who could be at your table? Instead of inviting somebody that might be strange, instead of inviting somebody, I think Jesus even said this somewhere, instead of inviting your friends and people who've been nice to you, invite somebody who's not nice. And sit them right there. And put your best spread out. They might become a friend. Okay, number four. Our challenge is not to be nicer in terms of hospitality, but to be courageous in hospitality. Our challenge is not to be nicer in terms of hospitality. I mean, the fear of talking about hospitality is, we think about buying some new napkins that make our table look nice and adding somebody friendly. There's that part, but it's like, no, it's not about being kinder. It's really going to the radical edge and making your home and your life open to those who really need a place. Like the Gibeonites. They knew they were outside of the camp. They longed to be in. And they made a daring effort to be part of that, what God was up to. And Israel, even though duped, made room and then proved their friendship by their actions. In fact, even looking at this whole passage, it's like the Gibeonites came with their bread and their wine. I don't know. There's a sort of a metaphor to the table. And Israel partook. And these two desperate groups were reconciled. In a treaty of peace. Even though the bread was moldy and the wine probably wasn't good. So, yes, we need to be courageous. But perhaps even in my experience at Pacific, we don't choose who comes through the door on our Monday night meals or Wednesday night meals. And all of a sudden, we're making friends with people who I would never make friends with, ever. And they now become part of a life. I'm not sure what people group God is calling you to do. And even if you inquire of the Lord or don't inquire of the Lord, if you oblige it in the name of the Lord, something good's going to happen. Just go. Do. Make this happen. Fill these seats. Serve together in this community. That's why I brought a piece of my table. What is this? The table extension. Right? Wait, it's sort of a cool table. We're selling it, though. $300. It's sitting ready to go. We got another table. But this is part of this table, and you just sort of put it in. And why do you extend the table? More people. There's more people. Because we always have room for more people. Boom. Add a few more plates. And when you think about the church, it's evangelism is basically extending the table. I like that metaphor much better. Evangelism, it gets too complicated theologically and whatever. And it's sort of a word. But extending the table is something you can all do. You just sort of add more water to the soup, as Darcy would say. You would never add water to wine, but you just extend your table and offer friendship in the name of the Lord. So, I'm not sure what Dave is teaching you. Probably no different, really. And Sid. And I'm blessed that I was invited to speak today. It was a great act of hospitality. Thank you, Candy. And I'm so proud and glad to be part of a community in Cloverdale where the churches are showing hospitality to one another, living in the reconciled reality so that we can declare to all of Cloverdale, Clayton, that God reigns. Let's live into that. Just don't be kind in your hospitality. Be dangerous.